Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Nutrient-rich freshwater releases from Lake Okeechobee have become an annual tradition here in southwest Florida. The releases are often followed by algae blooms in the Caloosahatchee River and the estuaries it flows into. Algae blooms were reported around the Alva boat ramp over the weekend, and more are likely to follow as the water flows west. For the rest of the hour today, we're going to hear a conversation WGCU's Mike Kenyre had with Dr. Bill Mitch and one of his graduate students named Lauren Griffiths, who's working toward her PhD. Dr. Mitch is eminent scholar and director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park, Juliet C. Sproul Chair for Southwest Florida Habitat Restoration and Management, and professor of marine and ecological science here at FGCU. He's been faculty at FGCU for 6 years at Ohio State University for 26 years prior to that. Their conversation starts by talking about Freedom Park in Naples and how it handled all the water dumped on it by Hurricane Irma last September. Lauren Griffiths and a fellow graduate student collected data before and after the hurricane came through, which showed that with some design modifications, constructed wetlands like Freedom Park could help to reduce nearby flooding during extreme storm events like Irma than as they are currently constructed. After that, they move on to a conversation about the 10-year pilot project at Freedom Park that is exploring whether it would be feasible to swap land use between agriculture and wetlands in order to remove excess nutrients from the environment. It's the beginning phase of a possible out-of-the-box approach to removing nutrients from water to avoid algae blooms like the ones moving down the Caloosahatchee right now. Dr. Mitch calls it flipping the landscape. Let's hear that conversation now.
Freedom Park is a 50-acre site. And about half of that has constructed wetlands that were built to clean water. And they work. And that, in fact, was Lauren's master's thesis at FGCU last year. She got her master's degree here, and now she's using a program that we've concocted with USF to get a PhD at USF, but she's based at the same lab.
Okay.
So in normal times, in the summer or in the wet season, they're cleaning up the water like they're supposed to be doing. What happened last September, as you well know, was a little hurricane came through.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to my team, my research team. We had our meeting 5 days before a hurricane hit. And at the end of the meeting, I remember him saying, okay, now who wants to go out and measure something during the hurricane? And I think they were all hiding under their desks.
The scientist in you is like, yeah, we have to get data.
Oh, yeah. It's a Twister movie. It's one of my favorite movies ever because the scientists win in the end. And so actually a former student of mine, she just left like 5 days ago. She got her degree in May here also. She was 1 year behind Lauren. She said, well, I could take samples during the hurricane of water going in and out of the wetlands. And I said, well, that's never been done before. Let's do it. And so she did. She hooked up. Oh, Lauren helped. I mean, they both were doing it as a team. And they actually got data. And that's the first time it's ever happened. And so that's why that paper was published so quickly, because it was unique to get inflow water quality and outflow water quality of one of these wetlands that's meant to clean up water. To get those kind of data. So that's where this whole discussion with the WWINC people last week came from, is that paper. We were hoping they would make a big deal of the graduate students getting data with wind of 100 mile an hour flying around.
Let's get to the data in a second, but let's start with what was the experience like in collecting the data?
Yeah, Lauren.
Well, so it actually wasn't quite as difficult as it sounds. What we did is we went out a couple of days before the hurricane actually hit and put auto samplers out, which are really cool devices where you can set them to collect water samples every 6 hours. So all we had to do was go out before the hurricane, strap these machines down with bungee cords and chains to make sure they didn't blow away during the hurricane. And then the machines did all the work for us. We came back a couple days after the hurricane and collected our water samples.
So you didn't have to be out there during the hurricane.
Luckily, we were not out there as the storm was coming over us.
No, but in a movie, they will be.
Right. So, okay. So then what did the data tell you, and were there surprises in it?
Yes, the surprise that we saw was that it rained like crazy. I think it was 27 inches, and we saw that fall in the wetland. You know, the water level went way up. But what we also saw, that was it as far as anything that the hurricane was contributing to the wetland other than the normal pump. And the pump was still working. That was what surprised us more than anything, because there's a continual pumping of water.
And the pump is what would normally be pushing water through the wetland if there wasn't a hurricane.
Right. But not nearly what a hurricane would deliver.
Right.
You know, like 3% maybe. So what we found was that nobody had designed the wetland for this so-called overflow that would happen when a hurricane came through.
Right.
And it's, in hindsight, it's pretty obvious that's a recommendation we're going to give to Collier County about fixing things and making it more hurricane-friendly, I guess you call it.
What would be the things that you would recommend? How could you make it to be able to accept more water?
Well, the water they're pumping from comes out of a ditch that goes right alongside the – in other words, this Freedom Park replaced a ditch.
Right.
50 acres of wetlands replaced a ditch that was just flying on by. And you intercept some of that water, but they don't intercept all of it. And certainly during a hurricane, they probably didn't intercept – very, very high percent at all. So all they'd have to do is design a system where the water would sort of flip over onto the site from the ditch rather than going out to Naples Bay.
So it would be a matter of just explain what you mean by that. I'm not sure I understand.
Well, when the ditch is just full of water, it's no problem to design a spillway, if you will, that could route the water to the wetlands themselves.
So it's really just – it's telling the water where to go or giving it access.
Yeah, the devil's in the detail. They might need pumps. They might not. But there's an enormous amount of water just flying past the site and not going into the site. That's our point. And so the wetland could have held a lot more water,
gotcha.
More for the flood control and reducing flooding elsewhere than cleaning water. But it also might clean the water too.
So what did the data tell you about the water quality? Did I read something about what was coming out was dirtier after the storm than normal?
A little bit, because what we were doing was getting an enormous amount of rainfall, which is pure H2O. There's nothing in it.
Right.
And it just pushed everything that was in the wetland out the other end and pushed so much out that the outflow nutrients or phosphorus and nitrogen was higher than the inflow, but only for about 3 or 4 days.
Gotcha. Okay. That was just because of the flushing effect, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So that is the idea of creating that wetland or modifying the situation there so it can hold more water. Let's talk about water quality now. You've embarked upon a 10-year pilot project of rotating use of lands. Is this the idea?
Yeah.
It's like rotating crops except rotating use?
Well, you nailed it, and a lot of people remember rotating crops. Our idea is the following. Wetlands, we know, will take nitrogen and phosphorus and nutrients like that out of the water. It's been done thousands of times around the world. And it stays in the soil, and it stays in the plants which fall down and become soil. So it's just the idea is the nutrients are accumulating in that wetland.
Right.
And it occurred to us that and I'll explain why we did this in a minute, but it occurred to us that to use those nutrients that are captured and recycle them, most people think, okay, pulling a dump truck up, taking the soil, put it in a truck, taking it off to a farm, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But we decided to look at a different approach, and that is flipping the landscape. So it's a wetland, it accumulates nutrients, then you flip it to agriculture. And it's very easy to flip a wetland to agriculture. All you do is pull a plug, if you have a drainage system, that is, and the water drops down, and you can plant corn or in case here, we thought sugar might be appropriate.
This seems like an obvious idea. Is this something that's been done elsewhere historically?
Not really. The closest thing, we found similarities to this in China, but China doesn't have this dichotomous nature of wetland plant and crop because they have rice, which is a wetland plant. So they got it all in one plant. So we're trying to – I mean, I'm a wetland ecologist, and I feel like we've lost, 80% of the wetlands of the world or some crazy number. It's off the chart. And I'd like to see some of that come back. And so where you have the opportunity for large-scale projects like this to create wetlands, have them for 3 or 4 years, flip it to agriculture for two, maybe flip it back to agriculture. You see what I'm saying? It's a flipping landscape.
Yeah.
We get the wetlands. The farmer gets some of the crops. and they don't have to buy fertilizer. That's the important thing. We got to get off of what I call a fertilizer opiate that we are on in this country. We are just absolutely ridiculously adding phosphorus and nitrogen to the landscape, whether it needs it or not, every year. And that's why we have messes like the problem we're having in Everglades now.
Mm-hmm. And Lake Okeechobee and the releases.
And then when I go up to Ohio, Lake Erie.
Right.
Same thing. Same story. Get in again. And many other parts of the world, too. So we're looking for a solution that's real, that stops the fertilizer source. And the only way you can do that is to be able to capture the nutrients and recycle them, at least for 100 years, maybe, till we spiral down to a clean landscape. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. I mean, and you know, what better way to get rid of excess nutrients and fertilizer than to grow more stuff with them, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
That's basically what you're talking about.
Yeah. But we also don't – our idea, the flipping – there's no chucks. There's no movement of anything. You just change the ecosystem.
So what is the pilot project, and what role are you playing in this, Lauren?
Well, so there's actually three of us PhD students who are all working on these small-scale wetlands and looking at 1 meter by 1 meter miniature wetlands.
Those are little kidney-shaped things that I saw. Mm.
They're basically little tubs that we got from a feed store. So instead of using it in for pigs to eat out of, we're putting wetlands in them.
Yeah, okay.
And planting them with wetland plants and seeing how they remove nutrients.
And where is this? This is at Freedom Park as well?
There's one at Freedom Park, and there's actually two up in Ohio right now.
Okay. And so over time, you will grow plants, you will measure the nutrients, you will see what that balance works out to be, and then at some point, what happens next?
Well, then we start the experiment. The first experiment is hydrologic, sort of. But once we decide, okay, we've got enough nutrients in some of these, we'll, you know, there's 28 of these tubs, so we got to we'll flip three of them or four of them or two of them and see what happens, and plant corn or
right.
a case down here, and we'll just see if the agronomy crop runs or grows well. If it doesn't, we say, okay, well, we did it too early, we'll try it again. And so that's why I've built in a 10-year experiment, because we're going to try it until it works, and then once the crop is doing fine with what the wetland captured, how many years will that happen? Maybe 1 year, maybe two, maybe three. And so that's why we have all the tubs. We can be flipping them or not, depending on...
Right. You can flip a few at 2 years, a few at 4 years, a few at 6 years or whatever.
Right. And unfortunately, it doesn't fit even a PhD schedule. So I have two PhD students. Lauren's helping a lot, but we have a PhD student up in Ohio who maintains the two up there, and then another one down here who's going to be maintaining this one. And they will get... probably just the data about the wetlands taking the nutrients out, and we'll give them a degree. but the experiment's not done, so we'll have another set of graduate students, I suppose. Or maybe, Lauren, you can just stay around as a postdoc, whatever. But we'll have another set of researchers who will follow the 3 years, and that's probably one of the more important times, because that's when we'll be very seriously trying the agronomy angle. And then... But I feel like it's a 10-year experiment before we get the right answers. And I'm not willing to say whether it's going to work or not. But if it does work, then we're ready for a 20,000-acre site or more.
That's, you know, that's over the horizon probably. But where would that be? How do you envision that working?
Well, down in Florida, it's easy. They built 50,000 acres of wetlands. To protect the Florida Everglades already. And they call them STAs. I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
Yeah, stormwater treatment areas.
Yes, because the lawyers don't let them call them wetlands. But they're wetlands, trust me. Anyhow, they're going to be wondering what to do with those things in 20 years. And I'll say, I have an idea. Oh, no, I won't be around, but somebody will say it. I'll say, that project Mitch did, he flipped to agriculture. So they're going to contact sugar people and say, hey, you guys like to buy, rent, or use our wetlands, but you have to trade. You have to give us some farm fields that we can flip to wetlands.
Right, do a swap, basically.
Yes.
Have you had any conversations with either side of the coin here when it comes to either the environmental advocates or the agricultural people inland as to how they would receive this idea?
the agriculture people, we've talked more with the ones up in Ohio just because we have two sites up there, are like, oh, well, that's interesting, Bill, but that might be complicated. They have their own agenda.
Right. Well, and they've always done it a certain way to some degree. Yeah.
Of gizmos and land, you know, buffer zones and so on. And they put a term on these things. They call them best management practices. Mm-hmm. You probably heard that term.
Yep.
So they're still stuck in their best management practice ruts, I guess I'd have to say. And it's not that they're opposed, but I've been interviewed by many newspapers, and whenever the newspaper interviews me, they will also get the viewpoint from agriculture. I can show you a whole stack of newspapers on that, and it's usually like a polite answer, but no, we're not going to do it kind of answer at the beginning. But that's the corporate agriculture, and that's not the farmer. I think what we're going to be doing is actually appealing to the individual farmers, because we're going to do a business model that makes it pay. And the reason I say that is because they're not going to have to buy as much fertilizer. That's savings. There are all sorts of conservation programs out there where you can get credit for just having a wetland on your property. And then there are the new thing on the block, and that's what Lauren's going to be working on, is carbon sequestration in wetlands. They are the best system on the planet for taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it in the soil and keeping it there. So the carbon sequestration has an economic end to it. I mean, people are trying to calculate what a pound of carbon's worth these days.
Right, right.
And everybody has different theories on that. But eventually there's going to be a carbon economy.
He said that's what Lauren's going to be working on. What do you mean by that? And what are you going to be working on, Lauren?
Well, so what I'm kind of getting into more now than the nutrients is looking at how carbon storage in wetlands is impacted all throughout the Caribbean in coastal systems by hurricanes. And so we just had a big hurricane, and I'm looking at how that may either increase, decrease carbon storage as a whole in these wetlands.
How do you measure that?
There's a few different ways, but the way that I'm looking at is taking soil cores. And so we'll take really fairly shallow cores and measure the amount of carbon, also date that soil,
mm-hmm.
and see over the last 10 years how carbon storage has changed. And specifically looking at this last year where we just had a hurricane, see if it's average, above average, from the last 10 years.
What is your hypothesis moving forward on this? What do you think you're going to find?
Well, so there's a couple of different ideas. And one of the thoughts is that the closer to the coast you are, the more impacted it is by erosion. So you may actually be losing a lot of the soil and a lot of the carbon that's being stored in that soil just by tidal action, wave action. Whereas the more inland sites are getting a lot more of that eroded soil, and so long-term, they're storing a lot of carbon.
Hmm. What is the application of this once you've done the research?
Well, so hopefully what this will do is show land managers and show local governments how important it is to protect these wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, if we're building right up to the coastline, we could be getting rid of a lot of this carbon storage and actually releasing a lot more carbon back into the atmosphere. Whereas if we know that maybe a mile from shore we're storing the most carbon, in, especially during these big storm events, that this may be an area where we need more protection of wetlands.
You know, it's interesting because, well, A, the closer to the water you are, the more valuable the real estate mm-hmm. is. But B, with sea level rise, coastal real estate is starting to look a little bit iffy. And then C, yep. this might be a way to kind of sort those two things out. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And there's a concept also called coastal squeeze, where like everybody's familiar with down here with Tamiami Trails. It goes across the lower Everglades to Miami from here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're viewing that now as a – it's not a bridge.
It's a dam.
It's a dam.
Yeah.
And as sea level rises, we're going to be squeezing out perhaps the wetlands on the ocean side of that highway because they have nowhere to go. They're going to get squeezed out. So I've been on public radio, on the national public radio, and calling for changing that entire 78 miles to a bridge.
Right. I've heard of. Go ahead.
I was just saying, and they've done 2.2 miles of it.
Right.
So they've got to start. But
let's talk about, you know, we have all this water that they have to release out of Lake Okeechobee because of safety reasons. It's got nutrients in it. And so you're talking about, you know, trying to do this wetland flipping thing in order to remove nutrients. Do we have just enough space, though, for the amount of water? I mean, they talk about these stormwater treatment areas and these places that they can store water. But it seems like if you do the math, it's really just a very small percentage of the amount of water that gets released.
Well, they, as you well know, they're designing an EAA reservoir. Mm-hmm. And we've looked into that in great detail. In fact, we had a statement. I was working with the friends of the Friends of the Everglades, which was a very distinguished NGO, and we did an analysis of that project. And the one thing that keeps jumping back at us is, yes, you can physically pump the water down there, but it better be clean. Mm-hmm. It better be clean, and I'm not assured of that at all, because certainly the water coming down the Coosahatchee and down the St. Lucie are not clean even at all. So we've argued that you need at least 50,000 more acres of, and it might be more, acres of STAs, we call them wetlands, to add to the 50,000 they already have. Now, to put that in perspective, the EAA is 700,000 acres.
Okay.
So we're talking about 10% of the EAA has to be, if the right term is given over, to the people of Florida or whatever, even if it's private, they've got to give up some of that land for wetlands. Then we'll be okay. But right now they had a design for 6,000 acres, and that's it.
But 50,000 acres, according to your math, would be enough to help?
We think so. That's a back-of-the-envelope calculation I did, knowing the percent increase in water going south.
Right.
And I just used that number, and I said, I just looked at the numbers. I said, they're not building enough treatment wetlands to take care of all that water. That's when the alarm bells went off in my brain.
Yeah. I interviewed somebody from the Army Corps of Engineers a while back about the ongoing repairs to the dike around Lake Okeechobee, mm-hmm. and I asked him, you know, once you guys finish this projected repair process, which I think they're looking at like 2022 now or something like that, mm-hmm. if that would change how much water you have to release down the Coosahatchee and the St. Lucie. And he kind of said, we don't know, which is kind of like, okay, you're doing it for safety reasons, but then once you fix the safety problem, you might not change the dynamic.
That's kind of a disturbing reaction, and I believe them. They don't know. And then on top of that, we've just got all sorts of climatic changes going on in the background that may negate everything we do.
So you're heading back up to Ohio this mm-hmm. weekend, and will you be working up there over the summer?
Yeah, because we have two of these, we call them wetland culture projects up there, and then we have one down here now. So, yes, we have plenty to do up there.
So you're not going up there for a vacation. You're going up there to continue. It is your summer break.
It's a break, but I'm always writing proposals or papers or whatever.
Gotcha. And what will you be doing over the summer, Lauren?
I'll be down here in Naples finishing up some research out at Freedom Park, looking at the nutrient dynamics, and then also getting into some mangroves and doing carbon sequestration out there.
Okay, cool. And last question, have you talked to any politicians about this? You know, there's a lot of politicians, especially now that the election cycle's ramping up, that are trying to get out there and talk about the need to do water this and water that. Have your ideas made it into any of their thoughts?
We're being very cautious about this. This is an experiment we're doing.
Right.
And we, for example, we have a site near Lake Erie, and that's being watched by everybody. But we're not ready to jump out and say it works.
Right.
So I'm just being cautious. If we get 2 years of data from the sites up in Ohio and maybe 1 year data down here and it looks good, then I think we can and publish a paper. That's what we do as scientists. We publish peer-reviewed papers, and if it gets accepted, that means scientists accepted it. Then I'm ready to go to Washington and
start knocking on doors.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
But until then, we're just being a little cautious.
Okay. Well, any final thoughts?
I guess my final thought is we've made a mess of our landscapes. for the last 100 years, just plowing up nutrients, and there's no end in it, and there's no real corporate solution to it, I guess I would call it. Many people have concluded that it was just a story in the Christian Science Monitor about our site up in Ohio, and they agree. There's what we're doing now, what we're saying in the press, and I say we being society, just is not going to work. And we have to do something different. So we're bringing something different to the table, and it might work. But our motto with all my students is, let's save the planet.
All right. Well, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was WGCU's Mike Henire talking with FGCU Professor of Marine and Ecological Science, Dr. Bill Mitch, and one of his graduate students, Lauren Griffiths. Our show today was produced by Mike Henire. Our director is Richard Chin Kui, and our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.